For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame. Playing the game, it'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey everybody, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and as always, I am here with my co-host, Kent Straith. Kent, what's up?
Who's got a great attitude is seeing Spider-Man tonight and a cup full of ice water. Think about it for a second.
Okay, sound effects, cool. I've already seen Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah, I know.
It was great.
That's what I hear.
Now my second favorite Spider-Man movie.
After, I'm assuming, Spider-Man 2?
Spider-Man 2, yes. Because Spider-Man 2, the scene where he fights Dr. Octopus on the train, is taken frame for frame from the comic book, and I had that comic book growing up, so I was like totally geeking out.
That was great. I really enjoyed Spider-Man 2. I saw it in the theater 3 times.
Okay. I cannot tell you how many times I saw it in the theater.
Probably more.
I worked at the theater when it came out.
Oh, well, that doesn't count. All right.
I got to see it a lot.
What theater did you work at?
When that movie came out, I think I was at AMC 30, AMC 40.
Oh, you worked at the Forum.
I did work at the Forum, yes, for a little bit.
What was I going to say? Oh, okay. Yeah, so I saw it 3 times. It was definitely my favorite of the Sam Raimi trilogy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
My sense.
I don't even count part three. It's like the Godfather 3.
My Sandman, sense Venom, of it. There was too much going on. My sense of it is that I really like the Avengers aesthetic and the sense of humor. And so I feel like I'm going to like this better.
Oh, yeah.
But we'll see.
Well, I don't know that I like it better. I'm just comparing it to other Spider-Man movies.
Oh, okay.
The fact that it has been brought into the actual Marvel universe, the MCU, I'm a big fan of. But that's neither here nor there. Today's episode, we're going to be... today's part two of LGBT Plus in America. We did part one a few months ago at this point where I think the episode was titled What Do Gay People Want? And it was a really good episode. A lot of traction. But in that episode, kind of this it played around the edges of religion in some way, shape, or form. It kept popping up. And so we decided that part two would specifically address homosexuality and religion. And so this week, we have 4 people that will be here with us, 2 here in studio and 2 on the phone. And so I'm going to introduce them all to the line here. For the first time here in studio with us is Brian Karcher. Is that correct? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
Well, Brian John Karcher possesses a computer science and engineering bachelor of science from University of Toledo. In Ohio?
Yep, from Ohio. I'm a transplant from Ohio.
That's gross. I knew I didn't like you. No.
Pop quiz, Brian. What's the University of Toledo mascot?
The Rocky the Rocket.
I can't think of it either. Oh, it's the Rockets. Okay.
And he currently works as a technology team leader at a large mortgage company in downtown Detroit, which we are refraining from saying the name just for legal purposes. He is the author of 8 books.
But it's possibly a mortgage company that may be able to provide me with fiber optic services or possibly a ride from New Center to America Park.
Probably.
Okay.
They may own all of downtown Detroit. He is the author of 8 books, 3 of which address the topic of Christian acceptance of LGBTQ people. Brian is an alumnus of the 2015 Reformation Project cohort created by Matthew Vines, author of God and the Gay Christian. He is the parent of an LGBTQ person, his son. Brian believes that the religious life and the homosexual life are compatible with each other. As a Christian, he fully affirms same-sex marriage, the plurality of the gender spectrum, and the right of individuals to explore and express their sexual identity, their gender, their orientation, and their own body in their unique ways. He further contends that the Christian church ought to be the safest place for such exploration and expression. Brian, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And let me just say, as I get older, it's starting to bother me more and more that I can't no longer tell how old people are. Because when I heard Brian has to save syllables, Brian has a gay child, my first thought is I didn't think he was old enough to have a child who identifies as gay.
His son's four. So.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. Okay, yeah.
No, that's how young he is.
Well,
no.
My daughter was just engaged last week.
So. Oh, gosh.
All right. Well, there you go.
I have no idea.
Next up, not in studio this week, but on the line for the first time, L. Michael Gibson. He's been on the show plenty of times, of course. But welcome back. Welcome back, Gibson. But L. Michael Gibson has a MS. L. Michael Gibson, MS, is a war.
This is where we're sharing.
Yeah.
L. Michael Gibson has MS.
Yeah.
I gave you a short one.
Sorry. You did. Is an award-winning writer and educator. Look, I pieced it into your old one, okay? Is an award-winning writer and educator and an art, youth, LGBTQ rights, and public health advocate. Gibson has worked as a consultant and senior administrator on issues focused on HIV/AIDS, LGBTQ advocacy, creative entrepreneurship, adolescent and sexual reproductive health, and community development programming over his 23 years of public service. A Chicago native, he now resides in Detroit, Michigan. Gibson is a progressive, raised, fundamentalist, evangelical Christian who has evolved into more of a Unitarian who no longer believes there is only one religious path to know and be in relationship with God. In terms of the compatibility of religion and homosexual practice, Gibson believes there are spaces of reconciliation and worship in the traditional sense, but if one is looking to participate in a fundamentalist, biblical, literalist sect, they are probably not going to ever reconcile sexuality with spirituality in a healthy way. Gibson, welcome back to the line.
Hey, glad to be here. Glad to be back on the show. Thanks, everybody.
Next up, also welcome back to the line, Miss Gabrielle, or Gay Moore, is originally from Washington, D.C., but now resides in Warren, Michigan with her husband of over 30 years. She holds a B.A., a Bachelor of Arts in French language and a minor in education. Gabrielle believes that practicing the lifestyle of homosexuality is not compatible with the Judeo-Christian faith, and that there is a liberal agenda that tries to push the belief that religious people who disagree with the homosexual lifestyle are hateful and bigoted. Gabrielle, thank you so much for being back on the line.
Thank you.
She's been on the show many times, but in some ways, it's like it's her first time here.
She changes her hair a lot.
I do.
She changes her hair a lot. She showed up and he was like, ma'am, what's your name? Oh! Gabrielle? I didn't even know. And then last but not least, he's not here yet. He'll be here on the second hour of the show, but Mr. Garland Travis. Garland Travis is a veteran of the United States Air Force. He lived in Germany for 20 years and has been married to his husband, Renee, since June 2011, after living together since 1998. An employee of the Department of Defense for 28 years, Garland was deployed to Turkey in 1992, Bosnia in 97, Afghanistan in 2012, and Iraq in 2016. He currently resides, I want to say Oklahoma, but I know that that's wrong. But either way, Garland put his personal relationship with God above any with God above any religious affiliation or participation. Unfortunately, religion, due to man's imperfections, poisons everything. As such, the reconciliation of human sexuality and religion is a moot point for Garland. So, Garland, when you come on the line in an hour, I'll welcome you then. But let's go ahead and dive right into questions here with the three people that we do have. What has been your personal experience with or personal understanding of religious teaching on homosexuality, specifically considering the Abrahamic religion, since everybody in the room is or has been within the Christian faith. So what's your personal experience with or personal understanding of religious teaching on homosexuality? And don't have to go in any particular order. Whoever hits the mic first.
Well, I'll start. First of all, this is Brian. I would say, first of all, none. Up until about 2012, maybe 5 years ago. So, yes, I am a bit older than I might look, but I had no experience, no understanding really, because it never came up until just the last 5 or 6 years. And then after that, then it's a wild ride. Then it's I've experienced everything personally from I've been condemned to hell more than you could count for the last 5 years. And then also to the other extreme, with Matthew Vines, I spent a week in Washington, D.C., The other extreme of the most amazing worship, I heard a transgender Allison Robinson, a woman, speak. She preached a sermon and led worship. And that was just amazing. It's the best amazing worship I've ever had.
Okay. So did you not have experience in and around this because your church didn't talk about it? Or did you not have experience until, I'm guessing 6 years ago, your son came out to you?
No. That's another podcast. But I grew up in a sort of a Bible religious cult.
Okay.
So we were isolated from the rest of the world. In 2012, I left that cult and was baptized.
Oh. Okay. All right.
So I was baptized in the Christian a Baptist church.
Okay.
And that was the last time I've been to church.
Okay.
I did it backwards. Usually people are baptized, they start church.
Right.
So, I was baptized and I stopped going to church.
Did things go exceptionally poorly immediately after the baptism?
No, it was amazing. I was just free. I was like, well, I'm done with church. Why do I need to go?
All right.
So I've been detoxing. And actually, President Obama is, when his comments in 2012 are what sparked my interest, and I realized the whole evangelical world, the church world, Christian world, was talking about these things, which I'd been isolated from.
Okay.
And so I wanted to get involved and understand it. And then about 3 years later, then my son came out.
Okay. Gibson or Gabrielle, either one of you?
The only thing in terms of what I've always learned, okay, is that God designed man for woman, and that's that. That it wasn't it wasn't man and man and woman and woman, you know. And so I tried going through the scriptures to see if I could find any times where God brought relationships between man and man and woman and woman in a sexual way. I don't see it. I do see some very, very awesome friendships that I do see that are there. So it's silent. If it was there, it's very silent that they were sexual. But everything I'm seeing through everybody that I'm looking at, you know, it's always been to be able to show you how to have a healthy friendship relationship with, you know, if you are two men, how to have a healthy relationship, and then with two women, how to have a healthy relationship. At least that's my understanding and what I've seen.
Okay. Gibson?
So I was raised extremely religious, fundamentalist Christian, Bible literalist, Kojic tradition would probably be as close as we can come.
Okay.
So you went to
church at 6 a.m. and got out at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
Yeah, had to go back for 7 p.m. service.
Remember that.
Yeah, and so, you know, and in the faith that I was raised in, homosexuality was akin to witchcraft or heresy or, you know, heteric behavior, like it was, you know, considered an abomination, and people who exhibited those behaviors were to be exorcised of their demons because they were assumed to have been possessed. And so I was raised under that belief, and of course, as a young gay boy who had started exhibiting behaviors that were not manly at a very young age, you know, this was deeply concerning. I've, you know, fast forward after kind of struggling, started coming to some awareness in pre-adolescence, and, you know, went to my church and got anointed with oil and supposedly got exercised, and nothing changed. You know, I still was looking at men the same way I had before, you know, which took me to a really dark place. So, you know, probably from 12 to 16, I was deeply suicidal and really struggling, and was always praying and fasting and trying to exorcise myself of these gay demons, as I had been raised to believe. And, you know, the only time I always tell people, the only time I felt like I was being an imposter or unnatural or not myself was when I was trying to have a girlfriend and trying to be with women. The being with a guy was like breathing. It was effortless. It took nothing. It was no thought. It was just easy. And so, you know, at 16, I just decided to live my life and to stop struggling. And my family, being who they were in the faith, that they were raised in kicked me out. And so I, you know, really was not part of any kind of Christian religion for a really long time. You know, so I have a deep relationship with those scriptures in Leviticus 18:22. Uncle posted them around the house when I lived with him.
Okay.
To remind me of what it is that I should be learning. Needless to say, they did not work. But okay. In any case, so yeah, that's my background with this stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to stop now.
No, it's fine. I grew up in kind of in this weird situation where I was raised Pentecostal as well. For the most part, I would say Pentecostal. And Pentecostal black churches when I was growing up, at least this is the way I understood it and felt, didn't do so well with youth. And so we go to church and the youth would have to sit in the service for the most part. And, you know, a lot of it was kind of over our head. And it was really about the parents just trying to keep the kids calm so that they could get church. But there was really nothing at our level. And so on Wednesday nights, my mother made sure that we were involved in a church that had programs that focused on youth. And so I was part of a program called Awana. If you're from a Baptist background, everybody knows what that is.
Me too.
Yeah, everybody was involved in that. And I was totally there for the competitions because they had all these games and stuff, and I was super competitive. Whether it was running around a circle with a baton or whether it was trying to get my Bible up, you know, and get the Bible verse faster than everybody else during a sword drill. That was what I was a part of.
Can we talk for 10 seconds real quick?
Okay.
Because this is never going to come around again.
Okay.
Awana games. Okay.
All right.
I don't think if they're being designed today, they're designed the same way. Imagine four kids running all in the – it's kind of like the XFL, right? You got four kids running into the center of a circle with their heads down after a bowling pin. It seems like the fact that there were no injuries in my Awana program seems like the anomaly.
That's so funny. I forgot all about having to run to the center. I was running around the circle. But either way, because there was nothing in the Pentecostal church for kids, my mother had us in this Awana program on Wednesday nights. We lived in Japan for a little while, and there we were part of a church that had something called Royal Rangers, which is pretty much the same thing. But really, just something that, you know, there's this saying to bring the cookies down to your level, right? So kids getting stories from the Bible that they could understand. And so in both of these situations, though, they were fairly religiously conservative. And so when homosexuality was mentioned, it was mentioned negatively, always negatively, never positively. It was not anything that God looked at positively. And it ranged from stuff that I know would probably make gay people feel uncomfortable and unwelcome. I remember being in services where the pastor would go on and on about, man, homosexuality is nasty. That is nasty. I'm like, okay, all right. I get it. There's probably some people in here who now feel like nasty people. To just plainly stating, the Bible doesn't affirm this. We can love people. We can bring them into the life of the church and make them feel welcome, but we can never condone their sin. And so, but in both situations, it was never affirmed. I've never been in a church where homosexuality is affirmed. I've been in churches where there have been people who are openly gay, who were leading worship, who were part of the church fellowship, but never would the church that I was a part of say, and their sexual lifestyle is okay. And they would couch it in that language of lifestyle, right? And I know that that's problematic for certain people, but that's how the churches I was a part of would frame that. What about you, Kent?
Let me refamiliarize myself with the question. My personal experience is a lot like yours without all the blackness or Pentecostal stuff. In that I also come from a obviously more suburban background, but a conservative Baptist, a lifetime of conservative Baptist churches. I've been to in my life one. I've been a regular attender of one. I'm sorry. I've been a regular attender of four. No, three. Regular attender of three. Churches all with the same doctrine.
No, six.
No, it's three. It's three. However, one for the first 18 years and then one for the 19 years previous to this date. So there was a there was an outlier in the middle. I didn't go there very long.
Okay.
It's a fine place. But yeah, and I would say that all of the teaching in all of those churches was similar to what you just said. I will say that the I don't think the doctrine or the official the doctrine and the official stance on homosexuality in my current church is probably the same as it was in the church of my childhood. It's just talked about a lot quieter and a lot less now because, well, one, my church has 11,000 people, and so there are going there is statistically some subset of people who are there every week that they don't, you know. But so it's not as vitriolic.
Okay.
Speaking of vitriolic, it's time for me to read a question. Intolerance is a word that is often used to describe religious people when it comes to how we view gay people. In many ways, this view is deserved. Why do you believe that religious people react so viscerally to homosexuality? I'll start. No.
Well, I got something to say on that. So that's something – one of the themes of my three books that I wrote. And one of the things I'm trying to do is with my books is to respect that reaction. So in many ways, that reaction is actually warranted because when you – as we alluded to in some of the introductions, when you say I affirm same-sex marriage, you're challenging their entire theology, the whole concept of God created man and woman, right? You're challenging that whole entire concept. So I'm not surprised by the strong reaction because it causes you to rethink or re-question your entire theology. And especially when you look through history, the past 500 years, the Reformed theology is specifically what we're challenging or what I end up coming against my books challenging is the bride narratives in the Bible. So when you talk about it's not just Adam and Eve in the garden. It's a theme that they've woven throughout the Bible, picked up on the bride. Jesus is the bridegroom or the bride, and all the theology is about preparing to meet Jesus, your bridegroom.
When you say, just for clarity here, mm-hmm. when you say Reformed theology, are we talking about like Calvinist theology? Just
exactly.
for people who are unfamiliar with what that might be. Okay, so you're talking about Calvinism versus like a Lutheran understanding of those
narratives. Yeah, specifically.
Because the narratives are there.
Yeah.
The narratives are there. It's just you're challenging a particular understanding of that narrative.
Right, yep.
Within
the
Calvinism.
Narratives are valid.
Okay.
I believe the Calvinistic history sort of takes those and extrapolates too much meaning out of that narrative.
Okay,
right. Because it's not a literal wedding. If they are saying it's a literal wedding, then we're talking about an orgy wedding with Jesus. Like, that's not what they mean.
Right, right, clearly.
So it's a specific metaphor that but the concept is the gospel gets bound up with male and female marriage, the perfect ideal. And when you're – my books and the things I've thought about with Matthew Vines actually challenge that. So it shakes your whole theological underpinning.
Okay. Gabrielle Gibson?
I don't think that I have a response as – angry, okay, because as I've discussed with my own son, I do believe that we have a Heavenly Father, and our Heavenly Father is a father, and a father he'll say, okay, son or daughter, this is my highest and my best. And you're a dad, so you understand. You would say, son or daughter, this really is a better path to do. You know, I'm not specifically addressing sexuality, right? As you're raising your children, you're always saying, okay, these are your choices in front of you. This is a better way to do it, you know? This is a better way to do it. So I believe that God's highest and best is that man and woman come together because no matter what, so far, a man and a man have not been able to come together sexually and reproduce, okay? And the will of God at the very beginning was, I want you to come, I want you to multiply, okay? Mm-hmm. And so well, in order to...
Well, boy, have I got news for you. You are behind the times. Go on with your story.
Okay. So in order to multiply, right. You know, even if you are a... if you are two men or two women, in order to multiply and you're married, you have to go outside of that marital relationship to make that happen, okay? And so I do believe that God's highest and best is for you to choose the man and the woman, but he has made man and women with thinking, reasoning, and being able to choose for themselves. He may not be, that may not be dad's choice for you, but this is the choice that you made. And he loves you even with the choice, but he does not agree with the choice, but he still loves you. And that's, you know, that's what I'm saying.
I do wonder if the...
So that's why I'm not angry when people...
And I get the procreation thing, and we're going to get to that a little bit later on, but I do sometimes wonder about that being used as a pushback because... You have infertile couples as well who have to go outside their marriage. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are people, we had a pastor at my church who, because of some surgeries that his wife had, they were not able to have, they tried very, very hard and they were looking at all sorts of, you know, in vitro fertilizations mm-hmm. and they were quiet about it because they said, you know, we said some things to a few people in the church and they're like, well, you know, no, it's God's will that you, that you not have kids or that you look at all the kids that aren't adopted out there. And they did end up adopting.
Yeah.
They ended up finding themselves in a situation where a young, you know, I think teen mother or mother who knew while she was pregnant she was unfit to be a parent. Mm-hmm. And they were able to adopt her one child. And then the girl got pregnant again and they adopted that second child. And, you know, Kent, you know who I'm talking about. But I think the indictment of having to go outside your marriage to create or to receive a child calls into question people who are infertile. And there are huge debates about whether, you know, technology allows us to, you know, kind of skirt around what might be God's plan for our bodies. But also people who adopt, I think that can call into question. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to call into question the design argument because we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that can be the totality of an argument.
I guess the way I look at it, how I'm seeing it is if every single man and man and every single woman and woman came together and they all said, I want to have a child, everybody has to go outside.
Yes.
Okay. As opposed to the number of people who cannot have children. And at one time, you know, if you couldn't have children, that technology wasn't there, right. You know. So right now, we don't have that technology where you can do that, you know. And I don't know, you know, I may be off the scene and God may give man a new way and, you know, and technology. But at this point, that doesn't exist. So my mind says that God meant what he said and that's how he did it. And you have to go to the opposite sex to get the child. You know, because his desire was to multiply. You know?
Okay. So. Brian, you wanted to respond, and I jumped in. Well, I'm sorry.
That's exactly the question I always ask when the argument comes up is, how do you resolve, like, the contradiction Calvin just pointed out doesn't sit well with my conscience. You mm-hmm. know, like, if an 80-year-old man and woman wanted to get married, who would say no? Usually they'd say fine, but there's not going to be children, right?
Right, true.
So for me, that falls flat. But the other thing is, you know, back to the question, why people react so viscerally. I appreciate you're not angry at the moment.
No, I'm not.
She won't be angry
so
at all.
Far, I'm
just
not.
Trust me on that.
Well, we'll see. No, but the other reason we've discovered, myself, in talking with people, and it happens all the time, the strongest opponents are often gay themselves or LGBT. And it's sort of this mechanism we have where I want to fit in, I need to belong. And like we just all mentioned, if you don't belong if you come out in most churches. And that's why one of my arguments is the church should be a safe place for that, regardless of the viewpoint. I respect that not everyone can accept my positions, but it should be a safe place to come out. You should be at least be able to talk about it, like we're doing now.
Well, let me push back, and then Gibson, I want you to jump in here. And Gibson, I think you've said something along those lines as well. You're like, you know, what are you hiding? And sometimes there are stories where you've got opponents, whether they be conservative Christians, whether they be conservative Republicans, coming out very strongly against legislation or against the inclusion of LGBT plus people in the church, only to find out that, you know, they're having sex on the side. I think it was a huge church.
And we found out they have a wide stride.
Yeah. You had a church out in Colorado, a huge falling out because a pastor was having sex with a gay prostitute and taking methamphetamines. I can't remember what his name was, but massive church that basically, I mean, they're still around, but it kind of collapsed for a little bit because of that kind of thing. But I do want to push back on the whole. I think that's a convenient narrative, but I hate that narrative because I know that it's not true. To say, you know what, if you are against homosexuality and you're strongly against homosexuality, you must be hiding the fact that you actually like men, or you must be hiding the fact that you really like women, because I think that there are people, and I've met people like this on a number of issues, but because homosexuality is that hot button one, but on a number of issues, they are vehement. And they see themselves as dogged defenders of the faith on a number of topics. I was talking to a guy yesterday. He's like, you know what? Homosexuality isn't really my big thing. I feel like we kind of lost a culture war there. He's like, I think that we have a huge issue with divorce in the church that we don't really talk about. And I feel like that's a bigger issue. But my issue is abortion. And so he's huge. But we don't say, you know, you're so against abortion because you're actually really secretly out there aborting a bunch of babies. Right. That's not a valid argument. And so I don't think that it is fair to say because you are so vehemently and doggedly against something, or you are doggedly saying that this is a sin because you believe it's a sin, that you really kind of want a guy to, you know, to have sex with you.
Of course, as a generalization. Sure.
Yeah.
You know what? I think people get mad when I bring this up, but not you guys, because you guys are cool. Abortion and homosexuality as the two hottest issues in the church are not as dissimilar as you might think, because abortion for a lot of people, I'm convinced, psychologically, is not about death. It's about sex. It's about consequences for sex and how you shouldn't be able to escape them. So homosexuality is about the wrong kind of sex, and abortion is about that slut bag had sex and she shouldn't be able to get out of it.
If you think babies are being murdered, I know people who just think babies are being murdered, and I'm not denying that there is definitely a connection to sex. And we talked about this in the pro-life, pro-choice episode like 6 or 7 weeks ago. I will grant your point, but I do think that there's an added caveat that makes this very different, where this is purely, well, not purely, but I feel like homosexuality is mostly about sex, and abortion adds this little thing of people being killed. So that's where I would differentiate. But for the most part, yeah. Consequences, sex consequences, I definitely get that. Gibson, jump in here.
Yeah, my view is very is more meta. So when I think of intolerance, and I think of hierarchies, I think that people are very invested in hierarchies in which they benefit. And so it's very convenient if you're a heterosexual to say the hierarchy that most benefits you is natural order is heterosexuality. Because it's a privilege that you get to enjoy and then be able to say the people who don't fit this, you know, just are out of the order. Similarly, like, and even if we know better from science, right? Like, we know that not only men and women are born, we know that people are born intersex with both genitalia. Mm-hmm. We had names for them informally, even right. Scientifically. And historically in culture understood that there was a third sex.
Yes.
And that's not something that is a few people, or a couple of thousand people. We're talking millions every year born. And so this idea that, you know, we know that there are people, infertility is increasing. You know, there are more women and more men who cannot have children. We do not deny them marriage. We do not deny them rights. We do not deny them privilege, as long as they're having sex, as Kent points out, the way that we want them to have sex. I mean, in this regard, I find myself often feeling like my homosexuality gave me great insight into all the different ways we like to place ourselves on a particular pedestal that others can't get on, that others are barred from. And I think that, like, from a psychosocial standpoint, we know that some people are just naturally black and white thinkers, right? Like, they want rules. They want things rigid. They want things, it's either black or white. There's none that is gray. And we know that there are other people who are fundamentally biologically predisposed to thinking in grays and considering other options and considering other points of view. Like, we know this from science, right? So some of this is hardwired. Some of this is just humans being humans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk specifically, and we've already been doing this, but let's talk specifically about Christianity, since this seems to be the background our panelists are coming from. Do you believe you can be a faithful follower of the Christian faith? I put out there on Facebook today, do you believe you can be a follower of the Jewish faith or the Muslim faith or the Christian faith and simultaneously be engaged in homosexual behavior? Why or why not? I threw that question out to Facebook, just a few responses that I got. One on the way here, I asked, I was talking to Dr. Saeed Khan, who is Muslim. He's a Muslim scholar. He's been on our show a number of times, especially on our Muslim in America episodes. But I said, can you be gay and a faithful Muslim? And he said, no. He says the Quran does not affirm homosexuality. As a practice of homosexuality falls under the purview of extramarital conduct that is prohibited. I said, but now they can get married in America. Does Islam shift? He said, that's marriage recognized by the state. It's not recognized by Islam. Analogous to a divorce not being recognized by the Catholic Church, despite it being recognized by the state. So that's Dr. Saeed Khan in talking about Muslim reactions to the homosexual debate. But Travis Figg said, two questions are relevant here. First, is homosexual behavior condemned by these faiths? Second, if so, is such behavior uniquely problematic? Regarding the first question, although there are passages in the Bible and Quran condemning homosexual behavior, there is some debate as to how they are to be interpreted. For instance, my understanding is that the ancient Hebrews associated homosexuality with certain pagan groups. And in Romans, Paul discusses homosexuality in relation to idolatry. I believe, Brian, you bring that up a little bit in your book Uncircumcised, which I have sitting next to me. Jennifer Blount, I'm going to have to find a spot, Jennifer, if you're listening, because when I put these questions out, I'm like, make them concise. We're going to try to read them in a little. She writes a novel. She's like, well, that's your problem with asking a philosophy major what their thoughts are. I was like, well, so philosophy majors can't follow rules? Maybe I'm a black and white thinker.
And here's 4,000 words yeah. on the subject.
But she says, is it wrong? I mean, I'm just maybe this might not be the best thing out of what she said. So sorry, Jennifer, if you're listening. But she asked the question, is it wrong for a non-heterosexual person to fall in love? To me, the answer is intuitively obvious to my conscience. There is absolutely nothing wrong with non-heterosexual romance that proceeds under the same spiritual and or moral guidelines that govern any romantic relationship. As to whether non-sexuality in general is sinful, I'll leave it to better study people like Brian to explain why a Christian should think not. So that was her answer. Just a couple of the answers that came in. On this question. So let's talk about that. Do you believe you can be a faithful follower of the Christian faith, since we're all Christians here or former Christians, and simultaneously be engaged in homosexual behavior? Why or why not?
Yep. Well, I'll jump in. So I think there's a couple qualifications there. I would answer it. I have two answers to that, if I can.
Yeah. Yes.
So,
I mean,
so,
they can't be any longer yeah. than Jennifer's answer. So,
yeah. That's for sure.
That's a challenge. No.
Challenge that, accepted. Yeah. But yes, please.
Let me read my book. No. For me, when you say homosexual behavior, I make distinction. If it's in the context of a marriage, then I would say absolutely. And I think. So I, when I say I'm affirming, I do not affirm things like extramarital sex, prostitution, is you know all that kind of stuff. I don't affirm immorality. So it, for me, the solution is marriage itself, the same as for heterosexual. So you absolutely can be a faithful follower of a Christian. And this question is similar to, you know, could you be an autistic child, right? There's nothing in the Bible that says affirms autism as a valid thing. There's nothing that tells us specifically in the codes, right? We have to infer it. We have to learn. And yeah, this autistic child should not be killed or ostracized. They could be a normal, healthy part of society. So same with that. This is kind of a bigger question to me. Christians tend to, in our day, ask, can you do this? Can you not do this? I saw a post, can Christians celebrate birthdays? Like, they want to know, is this behavior?
Not if you're Jehovah's Witness.
So there's this obsession with sin and what's right, what's wrong behavior. Mm-hmm. So my answer is absolutely yes. All of us follow Christ with sins, shortcomings, whatever your view is. But my more nuanced answer is specifically, can you be a faithful follower of Christ, in, I would say, in the context of a marriage, yes.
Okay. So now that's interesting that you say that, because for a long time, I guess if that's your position, it would follow for me. I'm just, follow the logic here. The church didn't affirm it for many years. There was no gay marriage from the church's standpoint. The Catholic Church would say that the church is that which confers marriage. And we get a marriage license from the state to be good citizens. But ultimately, it is the church that confers, marriage, right? And the consummation of that union is what makes it holy before God. That's kind of the understanding. And so by not affirming by not conferring marriage upon gay couples, they couldn't do this. Well, now the state will allow you to be married. So you can, if we were following the Catholic view or even the Protestant view, you can be a good citizen by getting the license. But the church, some confer, some do not. So then the question becomes for me there, the Christian sexual ethic, and we're going to get into questions of sexual ethics because this is what this is all about, really. Christian sexual ethic does not affirm any kind of extramarital activity. So that includes affairs. That includes sex with animals, sex with children. In my understanding, it also includes homosexual behavior and sex before marriage. Right now, we live in a culture where sex before marriage is just ubiquitous. I lived with my now wife before we got married. I just had to admit I didn't care. Right, I just don't. I want to do what I want to do, and that's what I'm going to do. And so now, in the churches that affirm. And now that the legal right exists, you now have the mix necessary for people to get married. So then, gay people who are having sex before marriage, are they now brought under that same sexual ethic, or is it still somehow different?
Yeah,
because the culture was birthed out of a not being able to be married.
Well, yeah, that's a very good point, and that's a valid line of thought that I've been trying to follow and work through. So when you talk about so for me, I think the church should not react to the culture, right? If the culture affirms something, it doesn't mean the church should. I like what you said about the Catholic Church is much more healthy in this respect because they follow their dogma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that changes – it does change, but very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I would say, yes, you it's the same sexual ethic. And for me, I make a distinction between homosexuality and sexual immorality. So in my book, I talk about something called a hypersin. So we've lumped homosexuality in with these pedophilia, these horrendous actions. Some people equate it to murder, right? So I think the terminology is wrong. We need to be more nuanced that there's homosexuality, heterosexuality. But just because you're heterosexual straight doesn't mean you're categorically sinful. I think the same rules apply. I think the same 1 Corinthians chapter 7, if we turn the page past chapter 6 that we get stuck on, you'd see marriage is a concession. It's the solution for passions. And I believe, like we'll get to it later, the statistics are skewed because we haven't allowed them to marry. We haven't had a safe space for them to engage in a healthy, normal relationship.
Right, but chapter 7 doesn't affirm gay marriage. It affirms, hey, if you were acting unseemly towards your virgin, then you should marry her. It's better to marry than to burn, right? It reaffirms the heterosexual normative as normative. Mm-hmm. So,
well, right. Yep.
I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I don't know that you could use chapter 7 of Corinthians to affirm gay marriage still.
Right. Well, just to be clear, there's nothing in the Bible that you could use, as we said, that you could affirm gay marriage, right? Mm-hmm. So, but what I'm doing is rereading scripture from a gender perspective.
Mm. Okay.
You know, so when you look at these passages from a gender perspective, actually you can't affirm women if you take the Bible literally. Women are in a very bad position, even though there's some things like they're included in the genealogy, but that's very minor. Women are in a very bad position if you read the Bible and take the gender constructs as God ordained.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing. So every time I use scripture, I'm using it through the lens of revisiting the gender language, right? Because otherwise we have to accept the patriarchal dominance. And if there's anything this country needs, it's white men to stop talking. But anyway.
that being said, we'll let Gibson jump in. Gibson, what's up?
Yeah, I want to jump in on this idea, this concept that only the church can confer marriage. And so, and the reason why I want to jump on this, as a black person who's a descendant of slavery, and recognizing that for some 300 years, our marriages were not, conferred by the church.
Right.
Okay. That, in fact, black people who were slaves had to enter a covenant with one another. So are we saying that black people for 300 years enslaved who were married to one another by taking covenants with one another, by taking ritual with one another, were not in fact married, but were engaged in fornication? Because if only the church can confer, the white Christian church in America, who was running things, said we could not get married.
Oh, absolutely. So, and in that respect, I would say, you don't base your theology on the exception to the rule. I mean, it's the same thing with, you know, the baptism. You know, Christians, according to the Bible, have to be baptized, whether you're infant, whether you're adult. There's room for disagreement on mode, but there's not disagreement on the fact that it's imperative. And people always bring up, well, what about the thief on the cross? Like, he was nailed to a cross and dying. He didn't have a chance. So you don't base your theology on the exception to the rule. So if the church isn't doing its job, no, I'm not going to tell you that slaves were not married because the church confers marriage, but they wouldn't give it to slaves. If anything, that gives credence definitely to Brian's case overall that, hey, the church is not conferring marriage to gay people. And in Brian, in your estimation, the church isn't doing its job, essentially.
That's exactly right.
And so, I mean, while I told you I'm non-affirming, right? But I'm also non-asshole. In that sense, I feel
and
like the
I'll
church
be ordering a bumper sticker later today.
In that sense, I would say the church is doing its job by not affirming. But on the slave thing, Gibson, I would say the church was dropping the ball on affirming. But that's I agree one way and disagree another.
Yeah, I so agree with you. I have. Let me tell you what. Now you all, you've used it. You've used it. You guys keep using the word church. I leave the church out of this. And Gib, this is what I have said, is that when slaves married, I believe that marriage is before God. I don't think man has anything to do with that. I don't think church has anything to do with that. I simply believe God is the one who ordained marriage. Okay? And so from that, during slavery, because I asked my pastor this, Gib, and like, okay, what? And I always ask, what makes you married? Who makes you married? Man doesn't have any say so on it. So they're saying, we're going to give them a license, and then we're going to acknowledge you so that you can get health insurance and all the benefits. Okay. But God is the one that ordained marriage. And from the scriptures, it was he who was the designer, the creator of this. So this isn't about man. So that is why, yeah, I guess I'm one of those people, Gip, that needs rules. And so I roll under the rule of the way he did it. You know, he went, when he sent Adam, you know, he brought Adam, he brought the woman, he brought Abraham and sent somebody out to go get him a wife, you know. So there was a man and there was a woman, and we don't see them going to getting a man to come together because he wanted them to multiply, you know. Yep. So
on that point, I absolutely 100% agree with that first, what you said there. Mm-hmm. I 100% agree. Marriage is before God. Mm-hmm. It's a divine thing. So my question then for you is, like, could God not do a new thing? You know, could God do a new thing? Like, we know if God brings something together, who are we to challenge it, right? Mm-hmm. So I've personally seen and have friends who are and we're actually attending a lesbian wedding soon. They are meant for each other. They are suitable helpers for each other. And it's clear when you talk to them, God brought them together. So that's really where I'm trying to adjust my thinking. I come from exactly what you said, Gay. Mm-hmm. And my background, like I said, it never came up. I've been trying to adjust and think and understand this. And so my whole premise starts with the fact that God is doing something. He's doing something new, and I'm trying to process it and understand it.
Gotcha. Real quick, just thoughts on that, and then we'll go to break here. Could God be doing something new? Yes. Is it likely that he is? Probably not. And I probably take a more C.S. Lewis approach to things, where he said in Mere Christianity, he said normally it's not the old theologies that are the problem. It's newfangled theologies that come along and are problematic. And I'm bastardizing what he said, but it's a great statement in terms of the rise of cults, right?
Yep.
And
I would agree with that.
My thought about that is, and we'll take it to just my walking out of my personal sexual ethic. Okay, so at bottom, religiously, I am non-affirming. Culturally, I don't care. If you want to have sex with a guy, have sex with a guy. If you want to have sex with a girl, have sex with a girl. That's just what I don't care. There's not enough time in my day for me to go in your bedroom to make sure that you're not having sex with each other. And at bottom, again, I don't want to shy away from the fact that sex is part of this. All right. However, when I was living with my wife before we got married, I never once, and maybe I'm just more honest, because I've met a lot of people who are like, you know what, my life is just beautiful, and we're meant to be together, and so God must be okay with this. And we have this idea and this need for God to accept us, right? Even at the expense of truth, even at the expense of what he has said he accepts and what he doesn't. And so if we're going by what the Bible says, if you're saying a Christian, you're saying, I believe the Bible, you can have different interpretations, but nowhere does it affirm homosexuality. And so, and you've admitted that much. And so never did I ever say, God is now okay with me having sex with my girlfriend, fiance, outside of marriage, because I'm okay with it, mm-hmm. right? That's assigning to God what I want him to be. And yes, there's lots of verses about love and acceptance. There's plenty of that, plenty of verses about liberation from slavery, plenty of that. But there are also, we talk about holy living, and we also talked about, you know, people are so caught up on what is right and what is wrong. Yeah, we are, because we're called to be holy, and in order to know what holy is, we need to know what unholy is as well. You know, what are we holy from? Or are we just kind of all doing our own thing? Does holiness mean anything if, you know, whatever we want means whatever we want it to mean? Mm-hmm. And so never did I say, God's okay with me and my girlfriend living outside of sin. I just said, I don't care. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I was in sin, period. And even after all that, if I saw someone who was living with their girlfriend, I wouldn't confront them on it. I wouldn't, oh, you know, I mean, that's just my reality. Maybe I'm wrong for that. Maybe I feel a little guilty doing that because I lived a certain way. I don't know. But I never once tried to say, this is right, because I want this, God's okay. And I feel like with, and I read most of your book, not all of it, honestly. I'm going to read all of it, though. But I felt like that is a lot of what came out in your book, which is very well written, by the way. If you're looking for a good read, Uncircumcised, Welcoming LGBTQ People into the Family of God is a fantastic read by Brian. But I feel like that is the hermeneutic or the interpretation, the interpretive lens that you're using here. And I find that somewhat problematic. We'll come back in about 10 minutes. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in 10 minutes. And Brian, I would love for you to address some of what I just said, because you also address some of that in the book too. So we'll come back in 10 minutes from the break. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for waiting on the line there. And for those of you who are listening live, sorry. Sorry about everything you had to go through to get this this call up and going. But now we can jump right back into our conversation. And Garland Travis has finally joined us here on the line. Garland, thanks so much. Thanks so much for being back on the show.
I'm glad to be back.
So we're gonna continue our conversation. But when we left off, I had made some statements that both Brian and Gibson kind of wanted to address. So Brian, I'll let you start off, and then Gibson, you can piggyback off of that.
Yeah, sure. Well,
all right.
Hello. Okay. Yeah. So So I believe. Oh, just to restate what you're saying. You were mentioning about how my book and a lot of my viewpoints come from sort of a hermeneutic that is driven by like a desire to be accepted. Maybe, is I saying that right? Like how would you say that?
Yeah, well, this is how I feel. Hmm. This is what I want. This is what is true for me. Hmm. But I also want to identify as Christian, or I find some solace or peace within this, or some truth within it, and I need to be accepted by it. So I am going to skirt around what it says about how I feel and make it accept, you know, how I feel. Whereas I said, you know, when I was living, you know, quote unquote living in sin, I was just like, I prefer to be in sin, and I'm not going to try to make it say something that it doesn't about what I want. And so that's where I was coming from and what I was saying. But you said you had some things to say that, and so did Gibson.
Yeah, so just briefly, so valid response, I would say. And part of that, I would say, comes from my viewpoint. First of all, I'm not a theologian, and I am specifically behind the scenes under the tone is I'm challenging Calvinism. And like I said, I've been done with church for 5 years. So what I'm coming from is a standpoint of working backwards. So often my thought process is more of a philosophical sorry to say, philosopher, not a theologian.
Okay.
So theologians will not like my book. There's many things. And my disclaimer is we'll all die with flawed theology, right? No one's going to have everything figured out. Maybe Calvin did. Calvin, the Calvin. Yep. This Calvin, I'm sure, will too. Yeah.
So John Calvin.
Right? So,
John not Calvin E. John. So. All right.
So my viewpoint, I often write from a standpoint of working backwards. So I've experienced things in my family. I've experienced worship. I've experienced LGBT Christian community who is vibrant. And I've experienced this sort of epic level reformation that's going on. There's so many affirming churches out there who actually are welcoming and with a clean conscience. And they're doing it with the Bible and because of the Bible, and because God is not only love, but God is holy, they are compelled, and I feel compelled to welcome them. So I'm experiencing that, and then working backwards. How does that jive with theology? And you're right, not all the answers in my book. I believe there are some start of answers. And I'm also following up on Richard B. Hayes. And I would encourage everyone to read Richard B. Hayes. I don't agree with him because he's non-affirming. His conscience is different than mine. But he is—he wrote one of the 100 most important books of the century, Christian books of the century. It's, excuse me, The Moral Vision of the New Testament. And it's actually, if you want to be a nice non-affirmer, I would suggest reading his book. And he—
I'm ahead of the curve. I haven't read it, and I feel like I'm nice.
Yeah. And you have theology.
Now get out of here, you filthy animal. No, we'll continue.
So just briefly, I'd encourage you to read his whole chapter called Homosexuality. And I really agree with his
thoughts. What's it about?
What's it about? Well, that's a valid question. He writes, he had a gay friend who died before he could finish writing that chapter. And example of Gibson on the line, he saw this reality and tried to think through it theologically. And he's an actual theologian. And he made several statements, one of which is, if LGBT people are not – he used the term homosexual, gay, because LGBT wasn't a thing in 1996. He said, if they're not welcome in the church in some way, shape, or form, I will leave the church. You know, so that's really the emphasis that I'm starting with. That there must be a way to welcome. There must be a seat at the table, even if your conscience doesn't allow it, even if we think God doesn't allow it. There must be a seat at the table. Empirical evidence is just massive now. Michael Gibson, I think, is the perfect testimony of that. If we assume God does not accept this same-sex practice, how then do they live? You know. So I work backwards from that. Like my friend from high school spent 30 years in reparative therapy, shock therapy, drugs. They did everything to this man to make him not gay, and at the end he's gay. So it's way more than a choice, and that empirical evidence is where I'm working backwards from. So I've started here working backwards. I've not met theologian. I haven't met Calvin yet. I don't know how I jive with Calvin. I obviously don't. But there's a lot of correctives I think need to be.
We're talking about the dead for 400 years, Calvin, right? I just want to be clear.
He's got some institutes that you can still fight with. So
I should say Calvinism.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gibson. You had made a statement that off air that I think is important for us to be able to address. You said the elephant in the room kind of deal.
Yeah, so, okay, so I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. My attitude about it, about homosexuality and spirituality, is that it's personal and that it's nobody else's business but mine and my Lord. So it's for me to work out with God. That said, there is an amazing work by Reverend Peter G. Gomes, J. Gomes, I'm sure I'm missing up his middle name, who was the Harvard theologian and clergy for Harvard University for a number of decades, who's black. He was openly gay, which I'm sure now shuts down the book for a lot of people. But he wrote a New York Times bestseller called The Good Book, Reading the Bible with Heart and Mind. And it was, his thesis was that the Bible is three things. It's a historical document, it's a cultural document, and it's a spiritual document. And when you approach the work, you need to approach the work recognizing those three things. We know, and this is something that, you know, people who do not believe in Christianity likes to punch holes in, you know, and Baldwin even famously punches holes in some of the tenets of the Bible, that we now know through science certain things in the Bible say are just not so. Like, the Bible believes that all life begins and ends with the sperm, with semen, with male, with men, and that women just was like a barren space that, you know, that life grew in. We now know that's not true. We know a lot about women's reproductive organs. We know a lot about how that works, right? Like, and there's lots of other instances where people like to point out these contradictions. And that's because as a historical document, we knew certain things that we now know something different based on science and reality. The other part of this is that in that context, homosexuality, as viewed in the Bible, was generally viewed in three ways. It was viewed through the lens of prostitution. It was viewed through the lens of pederasty or pedophilia between elders and youth, which was normalized in Greek and Roman societies, and is viewed through pagan ritual. Mm-hmm. It is not viewed when it's condemned. In the passages where people like to point out its condemnation, it is not viewed through the lens of love or intimacy or affection or any of those things. And so most of this conversation up to this point has been about homosexuality as sex. And homosexuality is an orientation, is more than sex. And if you recognize that it's more than sex, then you have to then look at the relationships between same-sex love in the Bible, between people like David and Jonathan, between people like Naomi and Ruth. So we know that those scriptures talk very vibrantly about same-sex love in ways that are romantic, right? And so it becomes about, where do you theologically sit on these things? Lastly, I'm going to say, if we're going to talk about Leviticus codes, I like to see the same fervor for all of the codes of the Levi priests that I don't think any of us are trying to become. So we talk about Leviticus codes in Exodus 18:22, and man shall not lay with men as an abomination, all of that, which is very popular. We also like to talk about Lot as a moral man. Lot, the man who had sex with both of his daughters and impregnated them both. So, you know, like, we have to recognize that biblical literalism is not always helpful in having a real interpretation of the Bible that's, I don't want to say reality-based, because it's inherently, because it is three different documents in one, and I'm going to shut up.
Okay. Garland, this is you're just kind of jumping onto the line here, but we were talking about, and I know that you've kind of walked away from faith, and you can tell, you told a little bit of that story on our Does Religion Poison Everything episode, but do you believe you can be a faithful follower of the Christian faith and simultaneously be engaged in homosexual behavior? Why or why not?
Well, I firmly believe that you can be a homosexual and still be, you know, a follower of Christ, you know, someone who's faithful to Christ. I don't think that you necessarily can do that and be faithful to most churches or organizations. So I guess, and I'm not trying to split the topic of the conversation, but for me, I have found solace in my communication and my praise and worship or whatever that I do between me and my Savior. And to me, that's more important than anything else as far as any church or any group of people and what they think or the concern. And I don't say that from a pompous point. You know, at the end of the day, it ain't the church, it ain't the faith that's going to get you there. So that's what's kept me, and that's just how I deal with my relationship with God or with Christ.
So let's move this conversation forward then here. We're gonna jump down a few questions, might jump back around. But those of a non-affirming religious disposition, and I've said on the front end that I'm religiously non-affirming, but culturally I don't care. Gabrielle, you were non-affirming. You said Judeo-Christian faith, it's not compatible. So those of a non-affirming religious disposition often argue, and Gay, you brought some of this up, often argue that homosexuality violates the created order, how God designed and intended things to be. Three violations are generally cited. One, it is the antithesis of heterosexuality. It is the antithesis of male-female relationships. Two, it violates the complementary nature of gender, that God created man and woman for each other. And three, it violates the duty to procreate. Gay, you brought that up directly. How do those of an affirming religious disposition address those three things? If they were talking to someone who said, hey, these three things are what it violates, and we're all kind of on the same page, like, hey, we're all Christians, and then one person said, well, you know, kind of violates these things, how would you address that as someone who's affirming or someone who is gay?
Yeah, I have several answers, if I can jump in here. Maybe just take the general question I always ask when that comes up is, are we in the Garden of Eden, right? So there's so many things that violate this created order, right? Like I gave the example before, autistic children.
Mm-hmm.
None of that was in the, you know, there's nothing to affirm that, but we know that we should love autistic children. So I have a hard time with the God's design arguments because, you know, we're not in the Garden of Eden. So I think we pull those, extrapolate too much meaning. But it's a valid question, you know, antithesis of heterosexuality. My response to that is I see sexuality in humanity as a plurality of genders. So I don't see a binary this or that. It's a whole plurality. It's a much more gray, 50 shades of gray, if you will.
Hope not.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, if that story took place in a trailer park, right, it would have been very, very different. Right. But continue, sorry.
So if you say it's violating God's creation order in terms of creating only two genders, I think that violates what we actually experience and see. Like we already mentioned, there's people born intersex. There's if you do the chromosome research, there's actually over 30 different combinations of XY chromosomes. And we all know this to be true. We have the example of tomboys, right? What's a tomboy? Well, it's a girl who acts like a man. You know, and there's also mama's boys. There's boys who are effeminate. Right, so there's all this whole plurality of spectrum of the gender, and all I can say is God created all those. Right, like it's hard for me to say that God didn't create those. Surely they were not created in the garden, right? And God intended it to be that in the garden. Nothing is like the garden now. Whatever God intended in the garden, nothing. I don't see anyone comparing human life now to the garden.
Okay, but you have societal. Okay, I am looking at a lot of, and I told somebody this, and let me share because I'm not saying it's this way because this is all I've seen. Okay, when I was a kid, I remember telling my grandmother I wanted to marry my cousin. Okay, I remember telling my grandmother that I was a little boy. Okay. And this was just what was done. You said, no, you're a little girl. Okay. And you were just told you were a little girl. And I asked, I said, is this something all little kids go through? And I was, people would say, yes, this is just something little kids are trying to find where they are, who they are. And so they would, you know, we would go with that. And so, I come from that way of thinking, you know what I'm saying? But children just from society, you know, some things you just pick up societally. You know, you're saying, okay, we aren't in the garden anymore. Okay, and you're right, okay? So society could be that effect. We have more kids raised in single-parent homes with boys raised by their moms, okay, because yes. the moms had to go to work, they may be a little bit more feminine. My son can tell you, I used to tease my one son, and I would say, put your hands in your pockets, put your hands in your pockets, right. because he was always moving yeah. like he was a female, but he was around me because my husband was at work a lot, okay? So a lot of it is affected by our society.
Yeah, and now you get into the gender expression, and that's a valid point. That's what somebody, I don't know if it's Gibson, said. Homosexuality is not just about sex. It's about those things. Right? Mm-hmm. This gender, there's actually four streams I talk about in my book from the Reformation Project where there's human sexuality. There's an orientation, there's biological, there's the gender expressions that society expects. Okay.
Yep. So Gibson and Garland, thoughts on that question?
Well, I was, when he started talking about the garden, that was actually my first thought as well, is that, well, yeah, once the fall happened in the garden, then that kind of, God's plan kind of went out the window for us. And I agree fully with that thought, and that was my thoughts as well. When you bring up the societal stuff and the norms and the feminism and, or not feminism, but, acting feminine or acting masculine, when you go back all through history, that's kind of also swayed at what male attire or what male hair. I mean, we wore white wigs and makeup at one time, and that was masculine. Mm-hmm. So, I think we have to look beyond society. Well, maybe we're in a societal shift. I'm thinking as I go here, maybe this is the era or the time where we're back to accepting homosexuality or, because we're going to have to do something as a society or implode, one or the other.
Okay.
Religion also. Religion is going to, they're going to have to make a decision one way or the other, or denominations are going to have to make a decision one way or another, because we keep moving forward. And not just in rights, but in acceptance. And that's not going to wane as the millennials come into authority and power and, us non-millennials kind of, retire a little bit.
Yeah,
I don't know if I muddied things.
No, I don't know if you muddied things. And one of the questions I didn't ask had to do with this being accepted by cultures at large. I tend to be very Kantian in my philosophy. And Jennifer... Jennifer Goosen, if you're listening, I apologize if I bastardize this because she's a philosophy major. But Kant, in developing his, kind of this moral imperative that he had, the way that he saw something being moral or immoral is you have to extrapolate it for the whole group. What would happen if everybody did this? And he said, if everybody had heterosexual relationships and had kids, society would continue to trek forward, right? If everyone decided to be homosexual, and this is using language of choosing sexuality. Right. So I apologize there for lack of a better term. But even if everybody just engaged in homosexual sex and only had homosexual relationships, we would die off within 3 to 4 generations, if that. He says, he could determine what is right and what is wrong based on those kinds of things. What if everybody lied? That would be, we can determine that it is wrong to lie because if everybody lied, all of society would collapse. And Garland, you brought up, we're moving forward and the church needs to survive. The church needs to change or die. And I've seen books that are even called that, why the church needs to change or die. And the interesting thing is the church has survived the collapse of societies, but those societies have not. And as a historian, I look at societies, and I look at societies that have collapsed, and we have this idea that all of American forward progress, it assumes that our society can and will never collapse. And the fact of the matter is most world cultures have collapsed, and they've collapsed under the weight of rampant moral decay. Now, I'm not saying that homosexuality is that rampant moral decay. But your argument is predicated upon the fact that forward progression is a good thing. And I'm pretty darn sure historically that many cultures that collapsed thought that everything that they were doing was forward progression. And now they're not here. Yeah. And so I think that is – there's been no culture that has accepted homosexuality as the norm. There is no culture on Earth that has ever accepted it as the norm for the culture. Of the cultures that are here and the cultures that are gone. But the cultures that are gone collapsed because of rampant moral decay. And Christianity, the Christian scriptures, because we're focusing on Christianity here. We decided to do that at the front end of the show. The Bible does not affirm, calls it immoral, and our culture is now accepting it. And you're hearing a lot of alarmist stuff that I don't necessarily buy into, but I don't think that all forward progression is necessarily progression. As of last week, the American Psychological Association, and this is something that alarmists said, and I'm not connecting the two, but the American Psychological Association said, you know what, maybe not all pedophilia is wrong. Would we consider that forward progression? The APA considers it forward progression. Mm. Do we consider that forward progression? And I'm not trying to compare homosexuality to pedophilia, because a lot of people do that to try to make an invalid point. But is all forward progression necessarily forward progression, yeah, or is it regression?
Yeah, it's a very valid point. And I would like to go back to something you said about Kant, because I have a bone to pick with Kant, that statement there, as you might imagine. So I agree with that line of thought. I would add to that, you said his Kant's paraphrase is that if heterosexuals all had children, society would keep going. My argument is if all heterosexuals had children, society would collapse faster than if we stopped having children. Because if everybody had children, we would have a crisis like never before.
That's what they there would thought not be in China, though, isn't that? And then at one point in China, they said, okay, you can only have one child because we have billions of people. And then a few years back, wasn't there this massive, massive earthquake? And people who had aborted children because they weren't sons, you know, that now they have this lack.
Yeah, they don't have enough people to procreate.
But I'm playing Kant's endgame. 100%.
Right. I get the point you're making. You're saying we go the opposite direction, be overpopulated.
If 100% did, yes. Not just part of it, but yes.
Okay.
So I think society collapses. But part of it is to do, I think, with the second point that you're saying earlier about the God's created order, saying that the argument is that it violates complementary gender, right? And maybe if you violate the complementary gender, maybe society will collapse. Like you're saying, there's some alarmists there. But I don't see the complementary nature being – so there's many ways that we can violate God's created order, right? Mm-hmm. And so the complementary nature is not a valid argument in my mind because of the image of God. So if you read the text in Genesis – the full 100% image of God is in each gender, the male and the female.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, that speaks a lot for women. I'm an fervent women's rights activist as well.
Mm-hmm. I believe God was too.
You know, yeah, I agree. So my argument there in that line of thought is that the full image of God is in both genders.
Yes.
You don't need to have your man to have the other half of your image of God.
Mm-hmm.
You are a woman, you are a man, independent of that. So the fact that you violate the complementary nature, there is a complementary nature there, but violating it is not such a bad thing in my mind because each one has the image of God.
Yeah. Okay. Garland, Gibson, thoughts?
Yeah, I have some. I keep getting cut off by the technology. Is everybody able to hear me?
Yeah, yep. We can hear you fine.
Okay, great. So I think that what was already said was essentially around, you know, we have 7 billion people. We have plenty of folk. You know, there's also this nature of God as being able to see all, right, and knows past, future, everything, right? So are we now saying God did not know that these LGBTQ folks were going to be a thing and have been a thing cyclically since the beginning of time, have gone in and out of acceptance since the beginning of time? That's strange to me. Like, we try to act like this is all new, and it's not. Even same-sex marriage as a concept is not new. Their antiquity has identified covenants between men as well. So, you know, there's that. And the other part of this is, like, lesbian women in America have more children than their heterosexual counterparts. I know several gay men who have children. Like, this idea that because someone is LGBT, they don't have children is not proven by science, by reality, by data, by now.
Wait,
Kip, are you meaning, you know, are you saying that they have them together?
That's not possible.
Right.
Well, often, I mean, so, no, lesbian women generally have most of their children young when they're struggling around their sexual orientation.
Oh, okay.
They end up having hypersexuality, hyper-heterosexuality while they're trying to screw the gay
okay,
man, excuse
okay.
my language.
Right.
Similarly, you know, there are plenty of gay men I know who have children in this way. So this idea that LGBTQ folks are not parents is not founded by the data. That's just something people make up.
No, we weren't saying that. I'm sorry. That's not what we meant.
And it's not something that the LGBTQ folks don't aspire to and don't achieve through technology and through means that are not technological, you know, through friends and surrogates and other means. So, you know, procreation doesn't stop because LGBTQ folks get accepted. Straight people who are absolutely heterosexual in their nature are not going to turn gay tomorrow. So these hypotheticals of everybody are just not rooted in anything real. They're suppositions that are rooted in fear and excuses to oppress.
I don't know if it's rooted in fear. And you know, here, let me back off of that immediately. There are definitely some people who are scared, and I'm not sure why. Like as a kid, I have an uncle who's gay, and I remember I found out he was gay, and I knew that was wrong. And we were at his house, and I would not go in the house. I was just scared that I would turn gay or something. Like I thought it was just in the air and I would catch it and I wouldn't like girls anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's how I thought it would, you know, work, right?
Just checking. How old were you?
Ah, gosh. When did I meet Uncle Jay? I
think I was 16 or 17, right?
No.
I think I was 11 or 12. Yeah. So, right. I mean, I was not that old. And my parents also never had the sex talk with me. They didn't sit me down and have that conversation. So I didn't know a lot about sex either. So I just thought, You could catch being gay from the air, just like people thought you could catch AIDS from the air back in the '80s, right? Like, oh no, but either way, geez, what was the point I was trying to make? Now I lost my train of thought on that. Oh, I don't think that everything's rooted in fear. I think when we're talking about the question of developing morality, and I brought up the whole Kant thing. If everybody did this, so that is a construct of how do we determine morality. I wasn't actually saying, you know, really, truly, what would it be if everybody did this? Because I have no belief that everybody would do this. But it's a matter of how do we determine the moral rightness or wrongness of a thing. And that's why I was using that example.
Well, let's look at heterosexual marriage. If half of heterosexual marriages in this country and increasingly around the world are ending in divorce,
mm-hmm.
is the threat LGBTQ folks, or is the threat y'all don't know how to keep marriage together?
That's a legitimate question. I think it's a different argument, but I think that's absolutely a legitimate argument where people are going, you know, we can't let gay people get married. And it's like, well, hold on, wait. If 53, 54% are getting divorced, so let's work on heterosexual marriage before we try to deny the rights of gay people to even get married.
Well, it's also raised to us as the ideal. If this is the covenant, if this is the ideal, if this is the natural order, why is it not working? You know, and there are lots of reasons for that, and there's lots of explanations. But, you know, to throw in the face of people that heterosexuality is somehow experiencing something greater, better, and then have us see what those stories look like in reality, you know, even when the marriages are still intact.
Right.
And not happy.
Well,
or violent.
And I hear you. And my thought and pushback on it would be, just because one thing is failing doesn't make the other thing over here the correct course of action. Now, we can fix what's broken within, you know, heterosexual relationships, and I can point to a lot of things with the rise of the necessity for two-income homes, with the rise of questioning of masculine and feminine ideals and ideas. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. We're gonna have podcast. I think you're going to be on the episode about masculinity, aren't you, Gibson? I believe so.
I don't know. You got me on some of everything.
Yeah, I do. True story, right? Such a good voice, right? And it's that voice you got. But
And on that episode about masculinity, we're going to be diving deeply into musical theater.
Please no.
As Gibson and I do off the air.
But I don't think that saying, oh, because heterosexual marriage is failing, that makes gay marriage okay. Now, as I said, I don't care.
Human relationships are complicated.
Say again?
And human relationships.
Oh, sure.
But what it does say is human relationships are complicated.
Right.
And that we're all trying to figure it out. And that heterosexuals do not have the corner market on having figured it out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely not.
If I could jump in there, too, that extended thought a little bit further. You mentioned, Calvin, about fixing what's wrong with heterosexual marriages. That's really gets to one of the main points I ask for coming to the church is when we're talking about homosexuality, there's no mercy, right? You're violating God's design, no mercy. In the case of adultery, yeah, there's mercy. And we get – so that's what I'm
– case of living with my girlfriend. Yeah. I mean, if anybody came at me about living – I mean, with the exception of like my mother-in-law and sometimes my mom – if anybody came at me like people come at gay people about me living with my girlfriend, I think I'd feel some angst, but very few people do.
Yep, and that's my point. I'm pleading. Well, I feel like some of the people came to Jesus pleading for mercy, right? Like if the non-affirming conscience truly thinks that people could change and become straight or whatever, these people need a way to live. And you can't live when you condemn people and say there's no mercy. That's my main point.
Okay. Is Garland, are you still on the line or did we lose you?
Nope, I'm here.
Okay, all right.
So it took some work to get him back.
Yeah, it said it was dropping him, so yeah. I just wanted to make sure that he was here.
I'm worth it.
So let's go. Have you said anything on this one, Garland? I can't remember.
No, but I missed the majority of it because they kept dropping.
Okay, so let's move to the next question then, and the final question of the night. And
I think we're going to...
We'll let Garland speak first on the last question.
Sure, and I think we're going to land the plane here because I have to get to Spider-Man. But, so what are some ways that non-affirming churches, all of them... No, not all of them, but what are some ways that non-affirming churches can include LGBT+ members in the life of the faith community? What are some ways that non-affirming churches and affirming churches can work together toward the common good and the furthering of their faith in the world?
Garland?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, boy. Well, just right out of the chute, looking for common ground is the first thing. I'm looking at the conflict resolution here in my head. Common ground as maybe the non-affirming can look for some common ground as to, besides, you know, being the choir director and the piano player, which they like that as long as you stay in the closet. But
Gibson said that a lot.
Closet station.
Because if they look at it as sin, all of the churches have sinners in them. So meaning whether it's the people who are sneaking around on their wife or they're, you know, sneaking around and, you know, drinking gin in the church bathroom or whatever in between services. So my point is that sin is sin. So how do they include those sinners in their church? Because they have them there. Whether they want to recognize them or not, they have them there. Now, they don't get them up and parade them around in the sense like, hey, look at this alcoholic here. He's in the back, you know, sipping gin while I'm preaching. But we also don't parade the gays around saying, hey, you know, everybody look at the gay, how great he is. Or, hey, look how great the straight person is. So why don't we look at the value, and maybe that's their ground, is, hey, let's look at these people as God's creation. They are human beings, regardless of their frailty. They are human beings. So maybe that's where they can start at. So if you can accept me as a human being, then maybe you can look at furthering that. And, you know, accepting and tolerating are two big different words. I don't want to bring that all up in, but a lot of organizations and a lot of countries and churches are tolerant and not necessarily accepting, but they confuse those two things.
Okay.
Yeah, so my answer to that is actually to extend those thoughts, dialogue and respect. So that's really what I'm seeking, what Reformation Project seeking is dialogue and respect. And Matthew Vines, our conversations, the programs he leads are called Elevating the Conversation, Elevating the Dialogue. Mm-hmm. So the only thing I really can't deal with is people who come to the conclusion and stop the dialogue, right? So talk, because we're talking about people. And like we just was mentioned, everyone's a sinner. Everyone has something to deal with. If the solution, if this gospel the Christian church really has is so amazing, why is it so threatened by someone who's gay? If this gospel is so amazing, we should be able to talk about people's concerns. We should be able to talk about people with respect for conscience, right? So, and that's what the gist of my whole book. The circumcised people in the first century could not reconcile with the uncircumcised. Those are incompatible. Either you're circumcised or you're not. There's no black or white. And you have 2,000 years of God's tradition. You have God's order that God ordained it. They couldn't reconcile those. So they didn't. What they did is found a path through the hostility, through respect and dialogue. And, you know, Peter and the people who valued circumcision, I believe Peter died thinking you had to be circumcised. I believe that. And Paul didn't. He said, you don't have to be circumcised, and you're a fully Christian. Now, they went parted ways, right? Paul went to the Gentiles, and he went to the Jews. So I think respect and dialogue.
Gibson?
I think to stop contributing to people's suffering in a willful manner.
Okay.
I think that, you know, if the church, you know, I don't subscribe to the whole, hate the sin, love the sinner idea. But if that's your theology or ideology, then, you know, as has been pointed out, make sure it's equitable. And if the church is a hospital for all, and we have no problems like showing and discussing and describing different interpretations and of other types of scripture, right? But we do seem to, when it comes to the fact that there are other interpretations of the scriptures that are pointed out regarding homosexuality, of which there are not many, of which Jesus Christ himself has never said anything about homosexuality throughout that walk. But he had plenty to say about backbiters and and people who are judgmental. And so, you know, I think that for me, stop contributing to people's suffering. If you're a space for healing, be a space for healing. Give people the option to learn and come to their own understanding between themselves and their God.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Well, we've got 1 minute.
Okay.
So.
Here's my question.
Wait a second. Right. Who is that lady? Oh, okay. Gotcha.
This joke is funnier if you were here in the studio before the show started.
Actually, Gay, just give us your thoughts on the question. I'm sorry. We don't have time for the question, unfortunately.
All right. So let me just say that for the non-affirming, one of the ways that healing can be done is to tell people the truth. Now, if we are saying that we're believers, then we are going to constantly say, this is what God says. You have a choice, however, to decide, am I going to accept the word as God said it, or am I going to do it my way? So if you're in a church, if you're uncomfortable because that person said, this is wrong, backbiting is wrong, lying is wrong. If you are uncomfortable, then maybe you might want to go where somebody is sugarcoating it and making it sound good. But I would say to do the right thing is to constantly say, what is wrong is wrong. What is right, and give. I'm not even talking just about sexuality. I'm talking about everything. You know, makes sense.
Yeah. So we got some differences of opinion, different landing points. Fantastic conversation per usual. Very cordial, I think. Despite the disagreement, I think Brian, you said this has probably been one of the best conversations you've had so yeah, I'm glad we're doing our job here. But
I think it's before we wrap up, I think it's important to say not counting Garland and Gibson on the phone. I anticipated when I saw the topic for the week not being in a room with three other straight people. Talking about gay in America,
yeah.
But you know,
well, Gibson was supposed to be here.
Oh, okay, all right. So there's that.
It just didn't work out.
We forgive you.
You know what? I mean, despite all that, and again, we got more into religion than we normally get on this show because it's again not a Christian show. Even though that I've, no pun intended, I've come out and said that I'm non-affirming. I do want to affirm the relationships that I have with both Gibson and Garland. I count both of you friends. I count both of you as people that I want to hear from, whose opinions I care about, and hopefully you feel the same way about me. Brian, also, thank you for being here. Gabriel, thank you for being willing to be here and being a contrary voice. I mean, that can be. I mean, a lot of people feel like I can't say anything anymore because it's not culturally acceptable. But also, thanks so much for listening to our listeners to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and last season, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks for tuning in. To those of you listening on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating. And tune in next week, where Kent and I have invited on a group of diverse people to discuss the contributions of millennials to the culture and the glaring problems of the selfie generation.
It's going to be a short show.
It's going to be a super short show. See you next week.